Welcome. Okay, so I'm Mark Wilds from Forest Hills, Queens. Pleasure. I'm very proud of my Queens upbringing. So it's like a little of a two-part series. Tonight is really just to get the story down and some insights into the story of Esther and some takeaways of why we make such a big deal about this holiday called Purim. And next week we're going to focus a little more on some of the contemporary messages, given what's going on in Israel and anti-Semitism rearing its ugly head throughout the world. There's just, if anybody's familiar even with the basics of the story, you know, this anti-Semitic dude named Haman somehow comes to power, and we have a queen in the palace, she saves the day. There are a lot of very interesting parallels between what's going on in the world today and what happened in ancient Persia a couple thousand years ago. So I want to, let's just start with a basic, simple story. When did this thing actually take place, this story? This is not a myth, it's not a fable, it's not a metaphor. It's actually part of history that we believe took place. And thank you so much. Thank you. And anybody know when? Like, give me a little bookmark on history.
Long time ago.
Okay, that's good. We could use that as a really...
Land of Persia.
Okay, so you remember back to kind of like social studies? Maybe you learned this in high school, college. What's that?
500 to 600 BC.
Okay, so Jewish people, we start out as an enslaved nation under Egypt. Okay, we finally get out. I'm going to give you a really quick overview. We get out of Egypt, slavery for 210 years. We wander in the wilderness for 40 years. And finally, we get to the promised land. And we build a temple. Anybody know who built that first temple? It was from
Solomon.
Shlomo HaMelech built the first temple. It stood for approximately 420 years until a certain empire came along that had succeeded the Egyptian empire. First it was the Egyptians, then the Assyrians, and then the Babylonians. The Babylonians and the Babylonians was the Nebuchadnezzar. He was the king of ancient Babylonia, and they toppled the first temple. Oh, you could take this if you'd like. They toppled the first temple in 586 BCE, exiling most of the Jewish people. And where did they go? Where did most of the Jews go when they were kicked out of Israel? By the way, thousands of Jews were actually killed in that terrible war, but most of them went to Babylon. Where was that? Like, where is Babylon? You look at a map, you're not going to see Babylon.
Iraq, right?
It's basically modern-day Iraq area, okay? And how long, just to give you a little historical, how long were the Jews in that exile before eventually coming back to Israel and rebuilding the temple? So it was not a long exile. And it has everything to do with the Purim story that we're about to speak about. Only 70 years. Anybody know how long we're in exile now since the second temple? Right, when the Jewish people came back, they rebuilt the temple under the more tolerant Persian Empire, post-Haman. And we rebuilt the temple. That temple stood for another 400 years. You guys following this? Okay. Until who came along and destroyed that?
The Romans.
To give you a little bookmark on Jewish history, Hanukkah happened about 200 years after Purim. Okay, about 200 years into the Second Temple, we had the Greek Empire, which toppled the Persian Empire. So it went like this. It went Babylonians, Persians, Greeks, Romans. And what happens when the Greeks tried to kick us out? Were they successful? We rebelled, and who are those people who rebelled? They were called the Maccabees or the Hashmonaim. Good. And we were successful at repelling the far greater and superior Greek forces from our land and reinstating Jewish sovereignty in the land of Israel for another 200 years until who came along? Took over from the Greeks, the Romans, and they were the ones who destroyed the second temple in 70 CE. So it goes Babylonia, Persia, Greece, Rome. Okay, so this is like world history. It's good stuff to know and just in general. Where do we find ourselves in the Purim story? The Purim story, we find ourselves about 70 years, and there's some historical debate about the particulars, but generally speaking, about 70 years after the Babylonians destroy the first temple. Okay? Now, here's what's really interesting. We do a lot of partying on Purim. Anybody know why we have so many parties and we dress up and we go to parties? One of the reasons we have a lot of partying on Purim is because if you read the story of Purim, which is found in the book of Esther, which is in the Bible, in the Torah, a lot of parties. Now, parties can be important because they can tell you what's going on, what's being celebrated, what's not being celebrated. And the Megillah opens actually with two parties. First party was for the military brass. Take a look at your handout. And it came to pass in the days of Achashverosh. Achashverosh, by the way, I don't think his mother called him Achashverosh. In some circles, that would be considered a decent joke, so you could just make believe that was funny. But Achashverosh was like a pharaoh, was like a Caesar. You know what I mean? It was like a title for a Persian king. So there was Achashverosh I, there was Achashverosh II, there were different. So it says in here that it came to pass in the days of Achashverosh, he is the Achashverosh who reigned from Hodu to Kush. Hodu is India, Kush is Ethiopia. Anybody have a little brain in their map right now that you can think about how vast was this empire? I'm thinking about the Risk board because that's how I know the map in my head. I used to play Risk when I was a kid. Okay, Ethiopia and India are on opposite sides. Like, it was massive. It's a world empire. And there were 127 provinces. So think the United States has how many states? Think the former Soviet Union had how many republics within it before it split up. Okay, think the United States and Soviet Union like together. Think like a world power. You've heard of the Roman Empire, you've heard of the Greek Empire, this is the Persian Empire. They were big, they were an uncontested, I mean, they eventually were put down by the Greeks. Alexander the Great conquered the ancient Near East and eventually took power from the Persians, and they took power from the Babylonians. This is what was going on in those times, okay? What's important for us is the party, because the Megillah opens, take a look. In the third year of his reign, in those days when King Achashverosh sat in his royal throne, what am I reading from, by the way? Where is this found? This is an excerpt. I'm reading from the Torah. Okay, in what's called Megillat Esther, the scroll of Esther. It's a scroll because it's meant to be read as a letter, because you'll see the theme of letters coming throughout this. And it's considered part of the canonized Hebrew Bible. We believe it was written by Mordechai and Esther in the aftermath of the story. Okay, so in those days, King Achashverosh sat on his royal throne, which was in Shushan. Shushan is like the capital. It's kind of like, you know, Washington, D.C. for them. And Shushan is somewhere in modern-day Iraq area. Okay, in the third year of his reign, he makes a feast for all of his officials and his servants, the army of Persia and Media, the nobles and officials of his provinces being present, when he displays the riches of his glorious kingdom and the honor of his splendorous majesty for many days, 180 days. This is some party. 180-day party. Who's invited to this party? Could you just show up? Who was invited? We just read?
Official servants, the army.
The officials, who else? The army. This is like the brass. Couldn't just... But when these days were fulfilled, the king made a 7-day feast for all the people present in the capital, Shushan. Anybody could go to that. And then it starts talking about the hangings of fine cotton, turquoise wool held with cords of fine linen, purple wool, silver rods, marble pillars. The drinks were served in golden vessels of diverse form. So that's getting very specific. Why does the Torah have to waste so much time telling us about these parties? Why are the parties so important? Who cares about the party?
To prove how much like power and wealth.
So the king's the king is clearly trying to show off his power and his wealth. But when people do that, when kings do that, I mean, I don't know if you've been to any of these palaces or you go to the these mansions, or I don't know if you've been to Europe and you see where some of the kings used to live, and the, you know, they have pretty lavish kind of, you know. But what else does it show when a king is really kind of really showing it off?
Power.
He's trying to show his power. Yeah. Why does somebody in general try to show their power?
They're insecure.
Yeah. If you're secure about your power, you don't have to flaunt it. King Ahasuerus was very insecure, and the Megillah, whoever, the author of the Megillah, wants us to know that he was nervous about his power. And I'll give you a little fun fact. The reason he was nervous about his power is because he married into royalty. He was a stable boy. Ahasuerus was a nobody. In those days, I don't have problems with stable boys, and I think people who are maintenance people are just as important as CEOs of Fortune 500 companies. But in those days, a stable boy could not pull out of his rank, out of his class system, unless he somehow married like a princess, which is what Ahasuerus did. Because Vashti, his wife, was the granddaughter of the previous Babylonian king, Nebuchadnezzar, who was a terrible anti-Semite, destroyed our first temple. But he married into royalty, and he became a king because of her. And she didn't let him forget that. But he was trying to assert his own independence and his own power. Now, why is this important for Jews and Jewish history? And another fun fact, it's not in the text, but we have many other books written. This is called the Midrash. It's actually translated, and I was studying it for this class a little. And it's rabbinic commentary on the Megillah. And it's part of the oral tradition, that we don't just have the biblical text, but we have a way of reading the biblical text that fills in some of the blanks. And the oral tradition tells us that Mordechai, who was the hero of the story, but he was the greatest rabbi of the generation, forbade, he put out an edict, a rabbinic edict, not to go to this party. Now, what's wrong with going to the party? Why can't I go? President Biden invites you to the White House. You're not going to go? Of course you're going to go. It's a great opportunity. They'll probably have glatt kosher food for you, and you'll get a tour of the White House, and you'll meet the president. What could be bad? And all the citizens of Shushan were invited to this party. And yet Mordechai issues a rabbinic decree, which, by the way, most of the Jews didn't listen to. They went anyway. Not to go to the party. The rabbis explain, because, what's wrong with the party? What's really going on? I said to you something about 70 years. There was a prophecy recorded in another part of the Torah, in the book of Daniel, that 70 years after the destruction of the first temple, the Jewish people would return to Israel and rebuild their temple. That prophecy came true, but Ahasuerus had bad accountants. I guess he didn't hire any Jewish accountants. He miscalculated. I think he counted 70 years, maybe from the destruction of the temple and not from the exile. And the prophecy was 70 years from the exile, and there was a few-year discrepancy. So he sees all these years go by, the Jews are not coming back, and he's happy because he doesn't want any threats to his authority. He doesn't want some big Jewish empire. You know, the Jews had a reputation of having a strong state in Israel. And he wants to basically conquer the ancient Near East and not be bothered by anyone else. So he throws a party. Now, ostensibly, the party is being thrown to show off that he's the man. He's the king. But the rabbis say that there was an additional reason for throwing the party. And that is to celebrate the non-fulfillment of the 70-year prophecy. That 70 years after the Jewish people would be exiled, they would come back. So now it makes sense. Why would Mordechai forbid Jews from going? How could you go to a party that's making a big l'chaim to the end of your people? I mean, that's basically what they were doing. And guess who came to the party? Many Jews attended the party. And that is teaching a very, very important lesson that the Megillah wants us to understand, that this is not just the story of a big, bad anti-Semite named Haman who tried to kill our ancestors, and Mordechai and Esther who saved everyone with God's help, of course. But this is also about assimilation, getting sucked into your culture in which you live, and also spiritual return, because that's what happens at the end of the story. Esther and Mordechai are successful, not simply saving the Jews physically, but really saving the Jews spiritually by getting them. Anybody know what they got them to do at the end of the day? What did Mordechai and Esther do when they found out about this terrible decree that the Jews would be annihilated?
They fasted.
Yeah. They, and not only they, Esther asked everybody to fast. Now, why do we fast? We fast on Yom Kippur to do what?
To
get a little closer. It humbles you and allows you to accept your mortality and realize who you are in relation to God. And Esther and Mordechai understood that, yeah, physically this is what was happening on the surface. The Jews were in physical jeopardy, but they understood that spiritually it was happening for deeper reasons, that they were losing themselves. And what they needed to do was not simply figure out a plan to take out Achashverosh and Haman, or to play off one insecurity against the next, but really affect a spiritual revival within the Jewish people. Because we don't believe bad things happen to us for no reason. Now, I can't tell you why October 7th happened, and I wouldn't pretend to know. You'd have to be a prophet, not just a rabbi, for that. But if we are the same people after October 7th today as we were before, then we're not doing something right. We're supposed to learn from things, and we're supposed to... I mean, one of the great things that's happened since October 7th is an incredible achdus and unity between one Jew and the next. And there was a lot of disunity, unfortunately, before. I can't tell you that's why it happened. I have no idea. But we are supposed to somehow learn and grow from what happens to us as a nation and as individuals too. You know? All right, I'm babbling a lot. Let me hear. Any comments, questions? Anything that makes sense about anything I've said so far? You're a very obedient group here.
So are the Jews here that showed up to this party, right? Did they, were they not aware of what Mordechai said, or did they disregard it? I'm just like,
it seems it's not clear, but it seems, it's a very good question, it seems as though they just didn't care. They were very sucked into Persian society. And not so unlike other periods in Jewish history. I don't know. Let's take America today. Let's say there was a party in the White House. And let's say there was some leader and ruler in the part in the White that wanted to celebrate, no Jews are going to go back to Israel. You're just going to stay here in America and be good Americans. And this Jewish thing, whatever. I mean, that wouldn't really happen so much in this country, because this country was founded on religious liberty and the ability to do whatever you want. But I don't know, how many American Jews would go to that party? And how many, if some a big rabbi said, don't go to the party. The party's making a l'chaim to the end of, you know, and how many people, you know? So there's a lot of repetition in Jewish history going on here. It's a great question. Yeah.
I also think that, I'm sure that period of 7 years was enough that, you know, people have kids, grandkids, and then eventually people kind of forget what it meant to have a temple and to be in Israel and all that. So,
Do you think 70 years is a long time? Because the way you're saying it is like 7 years is enough time to start forgetting.
I think it's a few generations. Yeah. I think, like, even if you pass those values on to your kids, it's a little bit harder to pass it on to your grandkids, and even harder to pass it on to your great grandkids. So I think 70 years is
like, 70 years. Would do any modern day parallels? 70 years, something like this happening. Well, the Holocaust was more of a attack, and there is, basically Haman wanted to do what Hitler was trying to do. So that's parallel. It's very parallel. But the idea of losing ourselves spiritually in 70 years.
Soviet Union.
Yeah, I mean, it's perfect. It's perfect. You talk to people in the former Soviet Union who were high-ranking members of the KGB, communists, atheists, like really bought into communism. And you could see pictures on their mantles of their grandparents with long white beards who were like Talmud scholars. And 3 generations later, gone. You know, it usually takes a little longer. It takes like 4 or 5 usually, you know. But the Russians managed to pull that off in 70 years. Wait, when was the revolution? 1917? And when did the former Soviet Union break up? In the 1990s? 91. Okay, from 1917 to 1991, there were 3 million Jews living in the former Soviet Union. 3 million. It was the third largest Jewish population in the world. Sometimes the second before. There were more Jews in Russia than there were in Israel at one point. Israel started in 1948 with 700,000 Jews. Russia in the 60s, 70s had millions, you know? And, I mean, a million of them went to Israel in the 90s and the 2000s. And then a whole bunch came here, and then whoever's left, you know? But think about that for a minute. How, this is not like some sort of made-up story, like this could never happen. How could you have Jews worshiping God in the temple, living in Jerusalem, holy, religious, Jewish lives, the whole community. And then the temple's destroyed, we get exiled, and 70 years later we're going to a party by Achashverosh celebrating the end of... Is that really possible? And if you're not a student of Jewish history, you think the whole thing is made up. But it's true. I mean, it happens. Yeah, you have a question?
If I didn't confuse, also I think the Hyman, isn't the guy called wanted the uncle to bow to him?
I'm sorry, I can't hear you.
The uncle of Esther to bow to him.
No. So we'll get further into the story. Basically,
is a security guy.
Yeah. So let me continue along the line. So at the party, Achashverosh calls for his beautiful bride, Vashti, his beautiful queen Vashti, to come and prance around and show off how beautiful she is. Some of the commentators does not say this in the text, say that he was asking her to prance around in the nude because it says in the text to wear her crown. She should come and wear her crown. And the rabbis say, what else does a queen wear other than her crown? And the rabbis say that means that just her crown, you know. Anyway, she refuses. And she publicly refuses to do this. And the rabbis make it clear that she'd not publicly refuse because she was a modest, pious woman who didn't want to show off her beauty. She had done this on other instances, according to the rabbis. This is because she didn't want to be told what to do by her husband and by the king and to put him in his place. And anybody know what happens? Is the king happy about this? He's unhappy about this?
He kills her.
Mm-hmm. Now, sounds a little harsh, but I guess in antiquity, you know, you diss the king, but there's something else going on here. He calls a cabinet meeting in the middle of the party, and the Megillah details, it actually says who showed up at the cabinet meeting. And they say you have to kill her. Now, one of the justifications was because then husbands will make demands of their wives, and their wives will just not comply, and it'll just travel around. So it seems like this is great women's liberation kind of moment, where she's going to say, you know, I'm not your slave here, I'll do whatever I want. That's not what's going on. If you just read the plain text, you might read that into it, especially if that's your take on things. But basically, his advisors were saying that, like, you're insecure to begin with. Your security is challenged already. You have to show you're the man. You have to show you're the king, and nobody can, you know, can diss you. So he has her killed. And of course, that paves the way for a new queen. And who becomes the next queen? Now, how is that? Why is a nice Jewish girl... What's that? They didn't know she was Jewish. But did she enter herself into this beauty pageant? It lasted for about a year. They put it out there. They want the most beautiful women in Shushan to come forward. What's your take on that?
Mordechai
put her up to it?
Mordechai signed her up.
Did he? Now, there's a whole discussion about this.
Okay.
Because it's curious. Like, I mean, Mordechai was supposed to be her uncle. The last thing you would want your niece to have to do is to have to submit herself to some heathen king and be in his harem. Now, the text in the Megillah says, Vatilakach Esther, that Esther was taken.
Taken?
She was taken. They didn't ask your opinion. they went door to door and they looked for the most beautiful women, and that was it. And Esther was beautiful, so they took her, and they put her in the palace. And Mordechai told her before she went that under no circumstances should she reveal her true identity, that she was Jewish. That's how she got her name, because the word Esther means hidden. She had to hide her identity, her Jewish identity, until it became part of the plan. That's how she basically got. Well, we'll get to that soon. So she's now, and she is beautified, and she's in the harem, and she's communicating to Mordechai. She's able to keep in touch with Mordechai. And there are all these theories. The rabbis derived from certain, but it's not explicit that Esther was his niece. It does say that she didn't have parents, and it implies that Mordechai raised her. So Mordechai was basically her teacher and her mentor, possibly her uncle. We don't really know 100%. But we do know that this was someone that she looked up to, and this was somebody that raised her as from a child. And she becomes the queen. And then what happens?
She reads to the
king. What's that?
She like reads to the king, and then the king was surprised that she can read. That's what I saw on the TV.
Maybe you're confusing that with another part where he wakes up in the middle of the night and reads something.
Oh, like he was just surprised that she can actually read. And then
where'd you see that? That's interesting.
This is like a Netflix Esther movie.
I didn't know. There is one. Really? Is it good?
Yeah, so basically she's like not complying with the whole beauty pageant thing, and she just doesn't care. She's doing like whatever. And then she like was reading, and then there was like, oh, she can actually read. Like it was her turn to go and please the king or whatever, like to impress him. And she has nothing to say. And then she saw this, whatever the documentation that was, or a book that was there. And then she's like, oh, you can read. And then the king asks her to like read. And that's how they kind of, that's how he liked her more than the other
girls.
That's
interesting. Oh, that's.
Yeah.
Oh, that's kind of a nice check for Ahasuerus, that he was impressed by her, that she could read, that she was intelligent, whatever.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Or maybe that's the Netflix version. Now, it could entirely be true because she was raised by Mordechai. He was a great scholar. Maybe he taught her.
Also, back in the times, a lot of people couldn't read, but a Jewish community was able to read.
It was more literate.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's also, that has a lot to do with her
upbringing. Very good. Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay, so she gets chosen as queen, and then what happens? She gets chosen as queen, and then we get introduced to this guy, Mordechai. What's his deal? Mordechai is this big rabbi, and Haman, who's Haman, by the way? Haman is more than a security guy. Haman is like, basically the prime minister. He has a very high position in the government. He's not the king. For whatever reason, and the Torah doesn't explain why, 100%, says one thing, why he hated the Jews. It all started with Mordechai. Anybody know? What was it about Mordechai that irked Haman?
They had like a past, like something happened, they were in exile together, or on a boat, came this up, and Mordechai wrote on the bottom of the shoe, Haman, and he stamped on it.
Well, the text just says the text says that he wouldn't bow before him, and Haman had this like rule that if you walk by his area in the main area, wherever Shushan, capital, you had to bow before Haman, and Mordechai would never do that because the rabbis fill in that he was wearing some kind of. Some kind of necklace, or with some kind of idol worship thing. I mean, the Persians were Zoroastrians primarily, and that could constitute idol worship. And therefore, Mordechai would not bow, and it irked Haman terribly. And he wanted Mordechai dead. And then when he found out Mordechai was a big rabbi, he didn't want just Mordechai dead, he wanted all the Jews dead. Now, it's hard. I struggle with this because the Megillah doesn't spend a lot of time on this. It goes very quickly into, and he hated Mordechai, and he hated all the Jews, and he wanted them dead. And my theory on that and I'm borrowing a little from what I was going to share next week, but that's okay, is that there really is no rational basis for anti-Semitism. I don't think there is for any form of bigotry. But there'll be reasons given. What are some of the famous reasons for anti-Semitism?
We control the government.
We control too many things. You know what? Haman argued just the opposite. That's what Hitler argued. Hitler argued that we control the banks and our daughters are marrying their sons and our sons are marrying their daughters. And we he used to call it Jewish science because all the prominent scientists in Germany at the time, which was true, were Jewish. So we control the science. We control everything. Hollywood, we control Hollywood. Don't you know that? And not a lot of proud Jews that are running the show over there, but that's another story. That's actually very, very interesting. I think, this is my theory, that the Megillah does not really go into the reason why Haman hated, because there is no real reason. Because Hitler could say that that's the reason they needed, you know, to rid Germany of its Jews, because we were taking over. Did Hitler really believe that? And did Haman really believe what he said to Ahasuerus to convince him to kill the Jews? Because as powerful as Haman was, he was not powerful enough to get this edict across. He would need the royal insignia of the king. So what did he say? He said, there is this one nation, and they don't follow our laws, and they do their own thing. They're like separate. The exact opposite of what Hitler said. And I use that as a little evidence that don't start, because a lot of Jews have done this over the years, let's analyze why the people of the world hate us. And once we figure out the reason, we can just change that about our personalities. And then they'll like us. And then everything will be okay. So, you know what? They hate us because we're keeping to ourselves. So let's get more involved. But then the next generation hates you because you're too involved. So let's pull back. Let's do our own thing. Well, that's not going to work either. If you go through almost every epoch in Jewish history, you'll find a different reason why the Romans, the Babylonians, the Persians, you know, attack the Jew, or today Israel. Can anyone actually give me a decent reason why Hamas attacked on October 7th? Like a rational reason. What's that?
They believe Israel belongs to them.
They don't want a Jewish state.
See, that's the reason they give, and that can sell. That can sell, because that's territory. And you can argue, it's not true, that Israel took their territory, and we're just taking it back. But then why are they trying to kill Jews anywhere they can find them? Why is it not simply happening in Israel? Why is anti-Semitism a Hamas form of jihadist anti-Semitism happening all over the world? Why are there terrorist attacks outside Israel against Jews? Or against people who support Jews like the United States? Because it's about Jews. And don't let Israel fool you. Don't let the temple fool you. Don't let whatever the reason that people give. There's a reason, because it's not politically correct to say, I hate the Jew. Nobody will say that, ever. Hitler did a little. But he gave these reasons. And he said, you know, and you know, Germany was humiliated in the Treaty of Versailles after the First World War. And they were able to somehow pin it on the Jew. As long as you keep doing that, you will be able to justify your persecution of the Jew. But when you start saying it's just about the Jew, then you're a bigot and you're a racist. Nobody wants to be called a bigot or a racist. And this is very, very important. So I don't really think it matters what, and I think that's why the Megillah doesn't spill a lot of ink over this. Why did Haman hate more? Because he wouldn't bow before him. Oh. So you're going to kill, I don't even use the word genocide, unfortunately, has been taken out of context, but that was an attempt at genocide. On the 14th of Adar, every man, woman, and child, Jewish, of Jewish descent, was supposed to be rounded up by the local officers living in the 127 provinces of ancient Persia. They were all going to be annihilated on one day. That was the plan. And that's what Haman got Ahasuerus. Now, how did Haman convince Ahasuerus to do this? Ahasuerus didn't seem to hate Jews so much. He married one of them. Now, he didn't know. He did find out later. Does anybody know how Haman convinced Ahasuerus? Because Haman was not powerful enough to do this on his own.
He played on his insecurities?
He played on his insecurities, and what else?
Astrology? Money.
Money, simple money. Haman was beyond rich. And the Megillah says that he offered to deposit tens of thousands of silver talents into the king's treasury in exchange for permission to annihilate the Jews. And Ahasuerus was like, Ahasuerus is basically an opportunist. Whatever worked for him, great. Kill the Jews, that's good for me. Save the Jews, that's good for me now. Because how did Esther convince, how did Esther pull this whole thing off? I mean, what did she do to save the Jews in the end? What's that?
She got rid of Haman.
She what?
Got rid of Haman and his kids.
Well, that happened later. They were killed later, but that's only after she got Ahasuerus to turn on him. How did she get Ahasuerus to turn on him? Very smart. Esther was very manipulative. And I say that in the most positive ways. She sized up the situation and she realized that there's only one way to take Haman and his terrible decree out, and that's by convincing Ahasuerus that what?
Haman's enemy.
That the Haman's whose enemy?
The king's enemy.
The king's enemy. How did she do that? What's the story? So basically, she invites Haman and the king to a party. And there's a lot of drama. I'm mulling over because I don't want to keep you here all night. But she invites the king to a party, and who else happens to be at the party? Haman. And then at that party, the king's like, you invited me to this beautiful party. You had something to ask me. What can I do for you? Until half of my kingdom I'll give you, my beautiful queen. And she invites him to another party. And guess who's at that party? Again, Haman. And guess who's sitting very close to Esther? Haman. And what basically she's doing is creating these thoughts within her already insecure husband. Mm-hmm. Husband, I mean, she was part of his harem. King, that Haman was after the queen and the throne. And at that moment when she starts, now, I didn't tell you there's a little of a backdrop. Okay. Haman had this vendetta against Mordechai. And he was talking to his wife, Zeresh. And Zeresh said, why don't you prepare gallows for Mordechai and his family? And that'll make you feel better, and crazy little things happen. I'm going to talk about this a little more next week. The king can't sleep. That's what I thought you were talking about. And he opens up a book and starts reading. And it appears that Mordechai, at one point, had saved the king from an assassination attempt on his life. What? How did this happen? The king became aware of it because he couldn't sleep one night. This is chapter 6 in Megillat Esther. So what do you do when you're the king and you can't sleep? He calls one of his advisors and says, open up the book of Chronicles. Open up the book of Chronicles. Guess what page they happen to open up to. The page where it records that Mordechai, who spoke many languages because he was a member of the Jewish high court, and he overheard two individuals plotting in the language of Tarshish to kill the king. Esther was the queen at this point already. He told Esther. Esther had told the people and looked into it, and they found the two guys. They hung the two guys, and they foiled the plot. And that got recorded in the book. This is, by the way, the Megillah is telling us this little story within the big story. After the decree went out that all the Jews are going to be annihilated on the 14th of Adar. You following this? Okay? The king calls Haman in, middle of the night. And he calls Haman and he says, what would you do to show honor to someone that the king has never repaid for their loyalty? King is thinking, Mordechai. He doesn't know Jew, not Jew. He's just, Haman is thinking he's talking about him. So he says, well, for such a person, I would have that individual ride around on the royal white horse with somebody very important from the government, telling everybody what this person did, and this is the way the king shows honor to those who are loyal to the king. And Achashverosh loves it. He says, "Perfect. Go take Mordechai the Jew and ride him around, and you be the person to." Okay, he had a prepared gallows for Mordechai. He's walking around with Mordechai now. Now, why is the Megillah telling us that story within the story? Because at the end, there's many layers here, and I'm only giving you the physical layers. There are spiritual layers that are much deeper. But at the end, when Queen Esther shows up at all these parties and is planting a seed in Achashverosh's head that Haman's after his throne and after the queen, and then she turns and then blurts out, "He is trying to kill me and my people." And the king says, "Who is this?" And she says, "Haman Harasha, Haman, the evil man." And she points to Haman. And it's all coming together. And then she says, he even is has gallows prepared for Mordechai the Jew. Who's Mordechai the Jew for Achashverosh now? He's the guy that saved him. Haman's trying to kill the guy who saved the king. It's coming together beautifully. She pulled all these little different things, but some of the things Queen Esther never orchestrated. Queen Esther never orchestrated the king not being able to sleep at night. And Queen Esther never orchestrated calling his advisor for the book. And then the book opens to the page with Mordechai. And then Haman comes in there with the suggestion. All of that seemed to happen. What's the name of this holiday? Purim. What's Purim actually mean?
Lottery.
Yeah. Why? Why is it called lottery? Anybody know? Because they drew a lottery to determine what day they should kill the Jews. What does a lottery seem to imply? Arbitrariness, randomness. It's just nothing makes any sense. There's no plan. Who else is missing from the whole story? We spoke about this last week. God's name is not mentioned once in the whole story. It's the only part of the Bible where Hashem's name is not mentioned, is not found anywhere. You know why? Because you could read the whole story without God, but then the whole story doesn't make sense without God either. Because things look like they're Purim. Things look random. They look arbitrary. One day, we're living it up, going to the king's palace for a big party. Or maybe we shouldn't have gone to the party, but we went. And the next day, there's a decree to destroy all the Jewish people. And then the next day, we're saved because we had a queen in the palace. What's really going on? And that's all hinted in the title, Megillat Esther, which literally means the scroll of Esther. But what does the word Megillah also mean? Legalut means to reveal. What did I say Esther also means?
Hidden.
To reveal the hidden. What is our task, the Jewish people? We are bidden, our job in the world is to reveal that which is hidden. What is the most hidden thing in the world? That's God. You can go through his whole life and just not see God. But our job is to demonstrate to the world that there's much more than meets the eye. And there's something lurking beneath the surface. And stuff happening in the world, not just happening randomly. There's a little of a Wizard of Oz pulling some strings in the back. Now, I can't tell you, again, you need to be more of a prophet than a rabbi to be able to say, this is happening because of this, that's happening because of this. I don't know. But I do know, and I do believe, that stuff that happens, happens for a reason. It's not arbitrary. And it's not just a lottery. Somebody closes their eyes, puts their hand in, and pulls out a number. It's all part of some bigger, bigger plan. So there's so many important themes here. That's a big theme, which is seeing that there's order behind the chaos. And the other thing that I want to leave you with, we'll talk a little more next week about the anti-Semitism and the other parallels going on now with October 7th and what's happening in the world, at the UN and other places. But think about that party. Think about whether we would go to the party. Or would we try to go to the party and say, wait, we can't lose ourselves. We have to stay Jewish. We want to be able to pass this thing on. Or are we going to just continue with what happened, what unraveled in 70 years? Where you can go from having a great-grandfather who was a Torah scholar with a long white beard, and the great-grandson, who's a member of the KGB, who believes in nothing, and could care less about what happens in Israel. Because that can happen. That happened here. It's happening in the United States in some level. And what role does what happened on October 7th? Is it shaking us up a little? Is it causing us to ask ourselves, who are we? What are we doing here? You know, what's going to be with our brothers and sisters in Israel? Will there be an Israel? You know? And I don't have simple answers for you. I'm probably leave you with a lot more questions than you had when you came. But this story has got a lot of wisdom for us to look at and to try to delve into. And that's why we celebrate Purim. And I think it's one of the most contemporary. I'm glad that Netflix made a film. It lends itself to so much Hollywood, this kind of story. You know, it's a lot of drama in it. But think about what Esther did. Think about how she sacrificed for the Jewish community and how she... Now, we don't have evidence of this, but there's theories that Darius was a great Persian leader, emperor. He was the one that allowed the Jewish people to come back to Israel after the Purim story was over and rebuild the temple. Some people say, and we were talking about this last week, that the temple, the attempt to rebuild the second temple already started before the Purim story, but it got halted, it got stunted, and they needed Jews to be able to go back, and that it was really Cyrus the Great that allowed the Jews, Darius and Cyrus were these two great Persian leaders, but they were a little more tolerant to the Jews, subsequent to the Purim story, and they allowed the Jews to come back. Some say that Darius was the son of Esther and Ahasuerus. We don't have proof of that. But some suggest that. But the implications of this story are very real for us today. How do we deal with A, being assimilated into some other culture? Do we completely lose ourselves? Do we need anti-Semitism? Do we need an attack on Israel to sort of wake us up to this? Because that's what happened in the Purim story. And then everyone came back. And the Purim story ends with a big celebration because we didn't lose our Judaism. We stayed Jewish. We kept it going. But not everybody went back to Israel. It was only a minority of Jews that actually returned. Most of the Jews actually stayed in ancient Persia and just stayed. Eventually more and more came back, but initially it was a very small number. Any other questions, comments? Pretty fascinating stuff. Yeah.
I'm going to assume that the Persian, line of succession was only for males because Vashti would have been queen.
She would have been queen, and that's a 100%. That's a very good assumption, right? It only went through the men because it was all about the king, basically. Yeah. Now most people kind of fluff over the whole Vashti thing because we just needed her out of the way to pave the way for a Jewish queen. But you really need to understand the role Vashti had to understand Ahasuerus and understand how Esther needed to kind of work off that insecurity that Ahasuerus had vis-a-vis Haman. You know? Yeah.
What's the part that Esther didn't like the rabbi to come to name Esther because he said he's not a wife killer?
Well, she's the real heroine of the story, Esther. You know? But there was a point. Next week I'm going to speak a little about another part of the Megillah I didn't get a chance to talk to about tonight. It seems as though Esther was a little hesitant. This whole thing that she did with manipulating the two, it didn't happen like that. I'm going to delve a little more into that next week. Mordechai had to do a little arm twisting of his niece. And I want to analyze that a little as well. And that's also relevant to what's going on in the world today in Israel.
Living
and not revealing your identity. I want to mention also that we'll be having a Purim celebration here at MJE. Not this Saturday night, but a week from Saturday night. What time is our event called for?
8:45.
8? Really?
Yep.
Wow. That's late. What time is Shabbat end?
Very late.
7:30.
No.
No. We talked about it, you said 8:45.
Maybe 8:40 to the party, but the Megillah reading we're going to start? Mm-hmm. What time is Shabbat end? We'll check it out. We'll get you the time. It's next Saturday night. We're also...
Happy hour on Monday.
there's a pre-Purim party, pre-game.
Downtown Gem Saloon Bar this coming Monday.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then, yeah.
Can I do my plug? On Thursday, before Purim, I'm actually doing a challah bake here. Mm-hmm. So there it is. You guys can already
And on Sunday, I want to mention also that, cute flyers, on Sunday we're going to be having a Purim feast in the afternoon and a Minyan Madness in the morning as well, if anybody wants to join us on the day of Purim. So Purim is Saturday night, Sunday. But we're going to continue this conversation next week. I urge everyone that was here tonight to come back so we can build on everything we said tonight. And not have to repeat everything. Okay.
Thank you so much.
Have a great night, everyone. Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Nice to meet you.
So nice to meet you. You should have a lot of nachas from all your kids. So that you have a son and a daughter.
And a younger one.
Oh.
She might come on Purim, actually.
Oh, cool.
But where's my youngest, school? She's in the high school. Applying to colleges.
Oh, wow.
She's a senior. She's the youngest one.
Well, vice versa.
Where is Abigail tonight? She said she was coming.
She did say.
She told me she was coming. The one that all your students are friends with her.
Where are my students?
I don't know.
Oh, where are your students?
Last week, all the girls that were
by
my mom.
All
the girls that were by you last week in Shabbat were my mom's students at SEA.
Oh, really?
Wait, what do you want?
They came here every year. They do about a 3-day trip here.
Somehow they had a connection and they saw my kids. So. I came back.
Well, we love Taryn. That's how we met.
I love Taryn.
Special person.
Best neighbor ever.
Oh, she's great. Have you met her dad?
Yes.